look at the sky. It hasn't fallen yet. Today, Thursday, October 17th. This is The World. So Congress has averted fiscal disaster, but the big issues are still unsolved, ready to pop up again a few months from now. And many questions remain, including some from U.S. high school students, originally from other countries.
The students are a bit incredulous. You know, one of the kids said to me the other day, don't we have like 230 years practice at this?
And later, we'll hear about the limits of revolution by social media.
In the end, that whole global sense of we can do it this new way is, in the long term so far, leading to movements with much less bite than bark.
Plus, buy a ticket, win a prize, and in this case, a Picasso. The artist's own grandson tells us about a unique online raffle.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. No more shutdown, and the debt ceiling is raised, but last night's last-minute deal in Congress hasn't lifted all the dark clouds hovering over Washington. Today, President Obama declared that after more than 2 weeks of fiscal paralysis, there were no winners, and he bemoaned the effect that the whole mess has had on our image around the globe.
Probably nothing has done more damage to America's credibility in the world, our standing with other countries, than the spectacle that we've seen these past several weeks. It's encouraged our enemies, it's emboldened our competitors, and it's depressed our friends who look to us for steady leadership.
The good news, said Obama, is we'll bounce back after this. But the deal in Washington doesn't really solve anything. It merely kicks the fiscal can down the road a bit to early February, when the debt ceiling will need to be raised again. Now, it's not unusual for politicians all around the globe to kick the can down the road. You could argue that the European Union has been doing that for the past few years with its own debt crisis. The World's Clark Boyd has covered Europe's economic struggles. So, Clark, the U.S. has been wagging its finger at Europe for the last few years. Does that mean that Europeans are now kind of gloating at the U.S. wobble?
I think gloating might be a little bit too strong. Certainly, the European Union, the United States, they're so tied economically that I think that any sort of gloating was mixed with probably a little feeling of queasiness. That said, we spoke with Peter Spiegel, who is the bureau chief for the Financial Times in Brussels earlier today, and here's what he said.
And there's been a lot of, to coin a phrase, a lot of schadenfreude going on in the Eurozone in the last couple of weeks. You know, people showing up and saying, look, the Americans are just as dysfunctional as we are. And it is that same kind of dysfunction. It is two implacable sides that can't come up with a way forward on the issues of debt and deficit.
So Peter seems to imply there that it's a shared debt and deficit between the U.S. and Europe. What does he mean?
I think it goes back to what I was saying. The economic ties between the Eurozone countries and America are very strong. They hold a lot of American debt. We hold a lot of European debt. So in that sense, the two are closely linked. And also in trade, Marco, the two are the world's two largest trading partners.
So there are parallels between Europe and the U.S. Are there contrasts as well?
Well, I think the biggest contrast would have to be the labor markets themselves. The American labor market, it's still very dynamic. There's still a chance for entrepreneurship to flourish. Where one of the big problems that Europe is dealing with is a very sort of sclerotic labor market. It's hard to hire and fire people. And, you know, that's the big difference still in the United States right now.
So now the Americans join the Europeans in kicking the can down the road. What underlying problems are both sides of the Atlantic just not dealing with? And what does this mean for the future?
Covering the crises in the Eurozone for the last few years, the one thing I've noticed is this, and President Obama has talked about this, governing by crisis, and that's really, I think, what the Eurozone has largely been doing, putting off dealing with deeper underlying structural issues in the economy. But what Peter Spiegel told us earlier today is when you don't deal with those long-term problems, it's really the rest of the world, some of the developing economies and countries that may actually reap the benefits. Let's hear from him again.
Those good middle-class jobs that, you know, both Europe and the United States built their economy on for the last century, those jobs may be going to China and India irrevocably. And that's the real concern, that unless those long-term structural issues are taken care of, and if we're going, you know, crisis to crisis and fighting the short-term fights, that those long-term issues are never going to be dealt with.
So clearly, Marco, it's a question of not America or Europe getting their economic house in order. At this point, it's really a question of both getting their economic house in order.
Today, President Obama seemed really at pains to point out how American actions have had and will continue to have major reverberations in Europe and elsewhere. It's encouraged our enemies, he even said.
After he made those statements this morning, he met with the Italian prime minister. And of course, Italy has been singled out as one of the sickest of Europe's sick men right now. And why are they sick? They're sick because of debt. Mm. And President Obama went out of his way to praise Italy for the way it's been tackling its debt problems.
Well, at least he'll get a nice table at any of Rome's great restaurants. The world's Clark Boyd, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Hopefully, what's been happening in Washington over the past 2 or 3 weeks is a teachable moment, right? But what lessons might your students draw from the whole shutdown and debt ceiling mess? And what do you say happened? Well, Mike Gwaltney is on the front lines of this. He's an 11th grade government and history teacher at the Oregon Episcopal School in Portland, Oregon. So welcome to the program, Mike. I gather you've got a fairly international student body.
We do. We've got about 20% of our upper school that are boarding students from East and South Asia.
Right. And so what kind of questions have they been asking? What kind of questions has the whole student body been asking?
Well, I think the whole student body wants to understand how the government can get to a point where we can't fund ourselves. The students are a bit incredulous about how every year we pass a budget. And you know, one of the kids said to me the other day, don't we have 230 years practice at this? How can it be so bad? The students from Asia are particularly incredulous because they think that this shows a level of dysfunction that they, as visitors here to the country, don't perceive as a problem. They think that this is the world's big democracy. We seem to be very effective in many ways. Why can't we do something as simple as sort of deciding how to pay our bills?
So what have you been saying to them? I mean, you kind of shrug your shoulders and say, sorry, this is just our country.
In some ways, that's exactly what I do, Mar. But, the bigger point I really try to work with the kids is this bit about how we can be in cooperation as human beings. So we're spending less time talking about sort of the nuances or the sort of strange, bits of how the house works. So I asked the students to think about where do you see yourself really committed to a particular position and do you have experience trying to compromise? And ultimately, I want the kids to think about how they can be participants in the democracy and think about how they would go about working with people who have very different positions than they do on things like the purpose of government.
I mean, it's funny. We just spoke with someone last week who focuses on negotiations and how people in Asia get to yes. And it's really about the many different ways of saying no so that you're all on the same page. So, I mean, for your Asian students, are they looking at this and just saying, well, isn't that obvious?
I think probably so. They're very willing to listen to each other and find middle ground very quickly, and perhaps more willing to do so than my, sort of the Portland, native Portland kids that I have in class, who I think have been raised, maybe this is paradoxical, but they've been raised in a democratic culture where it's okay sometimes to put your foot down and say, this is what I want come hell or high water. Mm. And a lot of the kids that come to us from these Asian countries just see compromise as more, part of the deal. That's how you live.
Do you have any kids who come from countries where there really are no functioning governments? And have they been talking about this at all?
We don't. One of the things that we do have are we have a number of kids who come from, to give you one example, Thailand, where they say that they are really committed to their monarch more than democracy. Hmm. Now, that's their perception as 15, 16-year-old kids. And one of the things they say is that, we thought there would be more functional government here because when we got here, we were told that democracy is, sort of better than monarchy to meet the people's needs. And now we're here, we see that there are, 50 million people without health care, and finally we've got maybe a health care bill, but we can't come to agreement on some basic things, therefore we'll shut down everything. How is that better than monarchy is a question that they ask. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
That king is looking pretty good right about now.
Well, if the king is going to give you, some level of comfort, not that everything is great there, the question is, what is the net gain of having democracy if some of the basic stuff doesn't get done?
Well, Mike, great to speak with you. Thanks a lot for your time.
Hey, Marco, it's my pleasure.
Mike Gwaltney teaches at the Oregon Episcopal School in Portland. Washington wasn't the only city where the art of negotiating got a workout this week. Geneva hosted the latest talks about Iran's nuclear program. No breakthrough, but representatives from Iran and negotiators from the U.S. and other world powers all said the talks were positive. The one negative note? Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's bad back. He was reportedly in a lot of pain during the talks. I asked Ryan Crocker, who served as a top U.S. diplomat for over 30 years, for his take on that.
A few days before the meeting, he was hospitalized for stress, and I assume that this is, again, a manifestation of that. I do ask myself whether this might be a political malady as he works to contain and deflect hardliners in Tehran.
I mean, if it is a political malady, it was notable that a number of diplomats at the Geneva talks gave Zarif advice for his back, offered sympathy. I mean, his back became kind of a talking point. So
yeah.
You're a former diplomat. Let me get some insider information from you. How crucial are these little personal moments in bringing polarized parties together? Can a bad back become the thing that breaks a deadlock?
Not in and of itself, but humanizing one's negotiating partners is an important factor in a successful negotiation.
What's the best example you've encountered of that?
Well, my own experience after 9/11 with Iranian negotiators, we shared our personal histories. I talked about my first Foreign Service assignment, which was in Iran, the respect and admiration I had for Iranian history and culture. I could quote a little bit from the great Iranian poet Hafiz. Mm. One of my Iranian counterparts was a USC graduate and recounted what a great experience his college years in the States were, and have left him with a lasting admiration and affection for America and Americans. These things all, develop an atmosphere in which it may be a bit easier to deal with the tough issues, but it does not substitute for hard negotiating. It just puts it in a friendlier context.
I mean, not to obsess about Javad Zarif's back, but in that case, could his physical ailment backfire as a political ailment, kind of showing weakness?
I don't think so. And, I have no reason to think that he is having a back problem. Whatever it is, I mean, I don't think that showing up in a wheelchair suggests that there is a political weakness on the Iranian side.
I mean, despite everyone being tight-lipped at the end of those Geneva talks, they were positive. What do you really hope, though, that the sides open up publicly about after the next round of negotiations?
Well, first, I hope that the next round of negotiations isn't the scheduled P5+1 meeting next month. I hope it's a continuation of the bilateral dialogue we started Tuesday afternoon. I think it's in that bilateral context that the tough work will get done, if it can be done. Second, to modify Woodrow Wilson's famous dictum, I am a great believer in open covenants secretly arrived at.
Explain that.
That in a complex and difficult negotiation with all parties facing critics of the process, we have them in the U.S., they have them in Iran, it's very difficult to make the sausage in public. That critics will seize on a particular statement, an offer here, a counteroffer there, that are part of a process and that can be highly tactical in nature, and use it to generate opposition to the entire negotiating process. I certainly would not have wanted the substance of my talks with the Iranians on Afghanistan while they were underway to have been a subject of public scrutiny, and neither did they. So I would hope that all parties to these talks keep to generalities until we are at the point where we have concrete results.
A good dictum for peace talks. Lawmakers in Washington should have been listening during the shutdown as well to that.
Well, there's something there.
Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Later on the program, Uganda's own version of Kenny G, really. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. For the past decade, American evangelical Christian groups have been at the forefront of the fight against human trafficking in Southeast Asia. Their emphasis is on sex trafficking. They've been so influential that Thailand now focuses on sex trafficking above and beyond other kinds of trafficking, like forced labor and sweatshops. That may not seem like a controversial shift, but some in Thailand say it's causing problems. Reporter Ruxandra Guidi brings us this story from Bangkok. It starts with a 24-year-old ex-prostitute named Mint.
Mint says she fell into sex work the way so many other girls from the countryside do once they land in Bangkok. She got a job at a factory, then a co-worker suggested she work nights at a bar. In 3 days, she made what she earned at the factory in a month. Mint says she wasn't forced into sex work, but a couple of years ago she nearly died when one of her clients attacked her.
I felt I had hit bottom. I couldn't go to the police and ask them to arrest that guy. I had no money to send to my grandma, no money for rent. It was the worst time of my life.
A friend suggested she seek help at a local church run by American missionaries. Min saw people dancing and singing and being joyful. That's when she accepted God in her life and decided to get out of prostitution, she says.
Now I can do good work that will not hurt my body. I don't have to fight all the time.
Mint now works at Nightlight International, an evangelical Christian organization that pays former sex workers to make jewelry. She's making a living wage, about $250 a month, though not as much as she did as a sex worker. Annie Dieselberg is Nightlight's founder.
In my opinion, any woman who is either at high risk of being exploited in the sex industry or is exploited in the sex industry is our target group.
Thai authorities are targeting this population as well. The U.S. government has threatened Thailand with trade sanctions if it doesn't improve its record on human trafficking. But General Chavalit Savangpue of the Thai Royal Police Anti-Trafficking Division says they've already made it a high priority.
We're always calling on all the agencies to take action against trafficking. And last year, the Royal Thai Police ordered all police units to spend at least 10 days each month doing anti-trafficking work.
Like staging raids and rescues at brothels. In 2012, the Thai Royal Police investigated three times as many cases of trafficking as they did the year before, but only made a couple of arrests. According to some critics, Thai police are trying to rescue people who may not have been trafficked.
I understand that there is an argument, a feminist argument even, that sex work can't be consensual.
Dina Haynes is a professor at New England Law in Boston.
It puts people in the victim role, but it also doesn't allow a conversation about how to solve or resolve, if we think it's solvable, underlying issues about why people choose this course.
It's an uncomfortable topic, she says, but some of these women have chosen sex work as the best paid job they can find. Trafficking isn't the issue here, she says. It's poverty and lack of opportunity, and the evangelical emphasis on rescue doesn't really address that.
I think the process of intervention especially needs to be expanded.
Krista Foster Crawford is an evangelical who works with NGOs that do anti-trafficking work in Chiang Mai. Over lunch at a restaurant, Foster Crawford explains that U.S. evangelical groups here are trying to focus more on raising awareness and prevention and not just rescues.
In a sense, it's way easier to go into a brothel and extract somebody. You have to check 6 months down the line to see if that person's still free.
28-year-old Mai is from Burma. She's worked as a maid, a dishwasher, baker, and street food vendor. She says none of these jobs allowed her to make as much money as she now makes as a prostitute in Chiang Mai.
There are good and bad things to any job, but this job gives me enough income to really look after my family and move ahead in life. I wasn't tricked into it, and I don't see myself as a victim.
Mai says a friend introduced her to sex work, a friend who was among many rescued in a police raid at a brothel a couple of years ago. She's since gone back to prostitution.
For the World, I'm Ruxandra Guidi, Bangkok.
Ruxandra's reporting was made possible with funding from the International Center for Journalists. Her story was about women who haven't been trafficked, but a new study attempts to quantify the number of people who are now living in modern-day slavery. The group Walk Free Foundation estimates it's about 30 million people worldwide. You can find out more about the Slavery Index at PRI.org. If you're one of those people who can't resist picking up a lottery ticket at the corner store, this next story is for you. I'm always tempted by the monster jackpots, but how about this for a jackpot? A $1 million Picasso. That's what you get if you win a raffle being held by the Pavilion of Art and Design in London. The prize in question is a Cubist painting titled L'Homme au Gibou. One of Picasso's grandchildren, Olivier Picasso, is behind this. So, Olivier, why raffle off one of your grandfather's works?
Oh, I think it's a very innovative idea to create a sensation over a foundation and a good idea to protect the city of Tyr in this case.
So you mentioned this city of Tyr. That's an old city in Lebanon. What in Tyr needs restoration? Why is this foundation coming to its rescue?
Because it's, historically, the founding city of our modern civilization in Western Europe and, of course, of the Western world.
So these tickets are not cheap. I mean, it's about $130 a pop. The odds have got to be pretty slim. Why not just sell the painting at auction? You might be able to raise more money, wouldn't you?
The decision has been made according to the price of the painting, which is something like $1 million on the market. But to raise more money and try to give a chance to anyone to get a Picasso for 100 euros. If you compare with an ordinary lottery, we have in Europe the Euro Millions, and you have one chance on 83 million to get the big prize. In this case, you have one chance on 50,000, which is a lot.
So were you the owner, or are you still the owner of L'Homme au Gibou? Did you donate it for this raffle?
The real story is that this drawing, which is a significant piece representing an example of cubism, was kept by my grandfather during all his life. And this drawing was part of the inheritance of the estate. So, in fact, it comes directly from the collection of my grandfather and has been sold since to a private owner.
Did you know your grandfather at all?
I was too young, but I realized how much he was important the day he died. When I learned about his death on television, which was for me a big surprise.
What do you think Pablo Picasso would say if he knew that this painting was the prize in a raffle?
My grandfather was a pioneer in every sense of the word, not only in his sentimental life, but especially in his creative genius. So he was interested in being not number one, but being a pioneer and looking at things like an adventure. So being someone who cared a lot about his family, about friends, and about political causes, I'm sure that giving away something to help people would have been something natural. So I'm sure he would have been proud and ready to do it.
Well, listeners, you can see L'Homme au Gibou and fantasize how a Picasso might look in your living room at PRI.org. Olivier Picasso, thanks for your time. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, the path to citizenship and why it's so long for some legal immigrants. This man from Egypt had to wait 11 years to become a U.S. citizen.
Every single time they said they could not find my file. Go get your fingerprints taken once again. I must have done the fingerprints and the pictures at least 5 to 7 times.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. With the shutdown and debt ceiling crisis behind us, at least for a few months, President Obama says it's time for Congress to get back to important issues, like immigration reform.
Let's start the negotiations. But let's not leave this problem to keep festering for another year or 2 years or 3 years. This can and should get done by the end of this year.
One of the sticking points in the immigration debate has been the so-called path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. But even legal immigrants face hurdles on that path, especially if they're from Muslim communities. As part of our Global Nation coverage, The World's Monica Campbell reports.
For most immigrants, the path to U.S. citizenship goes like this. If you've lived here with a green card for 5 years and don't have a criminal record, it should take a year or so to get citizenship. But that's not how it works for everyone. Here's someone who waited 11 years.
My name is Tariq Hamdi. I'm originally from Egypt. I came to the United States in 1977.
I met Hamdi at a cafe in L.A. He's tall, with a black beard, and he's a Muslim. He was 18 when he left Egypt to study engineering here, and he stayed. Found work, met his wife, had kids. He had a green card for years and didn't think much about citizenship until September 11th.
The calamity that had befallen this country, it tugged at my heart emotionally, and it made me feel no longer as an Egyptian, but as a citizen of this country.
In October 2001, he applied through the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or the USCIS. He was told he'd hear about his swearing-in ceremony soon.
It didn't come in 2002. It didn't come in 2003. I started going to immigration. I started talking to them on the phone. Every single time they said they could not find my file. Go get your fingerprints taken once again. I must have done the fingerprints and the pictures at least 5 to 7 times.
Hamdi says it was like fighting a ghost. But he knew that Arab and Muslim men faced extra scrutiny post 9/11. So he stuck with it. For Hamdi, becoming a citizen meant being able to vote, no risk of deportation, and visiting his family in Egypt without worry. He heard about Arabic friends getting blocked by immigration on their way back to the U.S.
So I was getting more determined. I was getting more. I never was discouraged. I was going to fight this out. Now I wanted the citizenship even more.
But in 2008, his application was denied. He didn't know it then, but he was on an FBI list. A list that could include people like Hamdi, never convicted of anything. Years before, he donated to an Islamic charity, thinking it helped refugees. The FBI later said the charity funded terrorists and duped donors like Hamdi. But that link placed Hamdi's application on a separate immigration track, run by a new program. It's called Controlled Application Review and Resolution Program, or CARP. And it has immigration cross-checking its list of people applying for citizenship with the FBI's.
The CART policy creates an additional barrier because it puts people on this track where they're purposely delayed.
That's Paul Chavez with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in San Francisco. He's working with the ACLU to pull the curtain on what CARP does. Through records requests, the ACLU found some of the triggers that can place applications like Hamdi's on the CARP track. From traveling to, quote, suspicious countries, wiring money, attending certain mosques, or, like Hamdi, giving to a charity flagged by the FBI.
One of the biggest problems we have with it is that it's covert, that you don't know, and there's no method in place to address it.
USCIS says CARP is about vetting, not profiling. Chris Bentley is a spokesman.
It would not be based on any type of demographic group or any type of sorting that we would do whatsoever, because we as an agency don't do that. And that's kind of period, end of story. It's all based on the individual case. I think that due diligence, if you will, is something that not only do immigrants expect of us, but the United States public expects of that as well.
Hamdi agrees, partly.
They should check the backgrounds. But if somebody like myself has been living in this country for over 35 years, I've not had one arrest, I've not had one conflict with the local police or the FBI, and for me to be delayed like this for all this time and be cast as somebody that's suspicious, that's a waste of resources, a waste of time, a waste of money.
It took Hamdi 11 years, but a federal judge finally ruled him eligible for citizenship last year. She swore him in on the spot. Hamdi knows he's an exception.
I'm confident that there's some other people that have been waiting longer.
But it's unclear how many people like him are still waiting for their citizenship or have given up. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Los Angeles.
We're holding an online discussion about the path to citizenship and why it's such a divisive issue in the immigration debate. You can submit your own questions to our panelists. That's all at PRI.org. Remember those massive crowds that seemed to fill every inch of Cairo's Tahrir Square, or the throngs that swelled in Istanbul's Gezi Park, or even the Occupy protests in the West? Well, many credit social media for the spectacular numbers of people involved. But what do those protests, which relied so heavily on Twitter and Facebook, have to show in the long run? The University of North Carolina's Zeynep Tufekci sees a boom-bust cycle. She says social media-fueled protests are far more likely to fizzle than the demonstrations that relied on old-fashioned organizing tactics.
It used to be that if you wanted to have a march on Washington, let's say, and you're the civil rights movement, it required an enormous amount of infrastructure, logistics, coordinate the buses, get the people, find the lists, the banners, everything. And once you had the march, that infrastructure was left to you as a sediment, as something useful for you to do that you can use in the next stage of the protest. Now, in Gezi, and I watched this, I went there to do the research, it was unexpected. There was no organization leading it. It was not even officially called for. It just kind of grew spontaneously. But they were able to organize, and they were able to carry out a multi-week protest and occupation of a park without having to develop, you know, a big organization that dealt with issues like negotiation, how do you represent this organization, what are its demands. So that's great for protests. But here's why it fizzles in the long term, because the hard questions and the difficult problems you would have had to solve to have the protests in the first place would have given you tools that you could have used in the second and third stages to be electorally active, to go into negotiations.
Zeynep, do you think that it is necessarily going to be a consequence of social media movements, or at least movements that start on social media, that they will be leaderless?
They don't have to be. This is a convergence of a cultural trend where people are disappointed with their leaders and would rather not have leaders. I think in the long run, if this boom-bust cycle is going to be broken, it's going to be because activists and people concerned about social change are going to look at it and say, well, you know what? We're sidestepping a lot of difficult questions, but then we're tripping up the second and third stage. We're not having policy impact. The March on Washington had a kind of impact that a lot of these movements, which have a lot of energy, a lot of people behind them, and you listed a bunch, there's many in Europe, yet you look at policy and it's as if these movements did not exist.
So you think about this stuff a lot, Zeynep. I mean, what kind of advice would you give to, say, let's just take, since we're talking about Istanbul, take Gezi Park and Taksim Square. What would have been the advice you'd have given to these kind of amorphous leaders and movement that was happening in order for some kind of follow-up to happen after the big protests?
I would say that people should sit down and think really, really hard about, are there some ways to have representation? Are there some ways to have decision making? Are there some ways in which we can enter into negotiations or electoral processes using these tools as aids, but in ways that are healthier and more accountable and that empower us, rather than saying we can do the street protest without leaders, we can do the street protests without, you know, organizational infrastructure. I think the movements have been taken in by how spectacular the protests have been, but I want to say, compared to the past, they do not any longer signal the same threat to authorities. And I think movements have to think. We had this all the same thing with Occupy. Mm. The Occupy movement in the U.S. did not have a set of demands or something that people could rally around and organize in their districts and run in primaries, which, by the way, the Tea Party did to great effect, as we've seen. So they, since they didn't do any of that, what the government could do was wait, attack with police force sometimes, let it get cold, let the protests lose energy, and then kind of just push it out without really strong impact.
So that's kind of the big contour of this dynamic with social media and the movement in Istanbul. I mean, you were there, Zeynep. You interviewed hundreds of people. Looking back now, look into some of the nuance that you saw and heard while you were there. What stands out? What's a lesson we could not see at the time?
I was surprised by how similar the trajectory of the Turkish Gezi movement has been to every other social media fueled movement, especially in more developed countries. And I think in the end, that whole global sense of we can do it this new way is, in the long term so far, leading to movements with much less bite than their bark.
So you're saying, Zeynep, that what the protesters showed up for at Gezi Park and Taksim Square, they were there ultimately for naught?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that for the people who participated, it was absolutely a life-changing experience. This is something I think it's true for Occupy, too. It was a very different environment than anything people have seen. The solidarity, the friendships, the new ways of thinking. Because we live in a world where we're told a lot of times, you know, everything's about money and start working and nothing can change. And just having, even if it's a few weeks, to live in an environment where everything is possible or everything seems possible, I think is life-changing. I think what needs to happen is more thought on the mechanics of that change. And it's not as fun to think about the nitty-gritty of how can we do this. But I think once the dream is there, I think over the long term, we will probably see an evolution in tackling the hard problems.
Zeynep Tufekci, Assistant Professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks for coming in and speaking with us.
Thank you.
There's a sort of idealistic zeal behind a new digital project that's just been announced. The project's goal is to elevate and support journalists and allow them to pursue the truth. One of the first journalists on board is Glenn Greenwald, who's leaving Britain's Guardian newspaper after his work there with NSA leaker Edward Snowden. And the man behind the project financially is Pierre Omidyar. He's a French-born Iranian-American who co-founded eBay. Jay Rosen teaches journalism at New York University and has spoken with Omidyar about his new venture. What is this new project?
Well, the new project is to create essentially a new news organization, a new Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, if you will, but founded on different principles. So it's going to be a home for independent journalists who have their own voice and their own subject matter expertise. And also a new online news service that serves the general user.
On a digital platform, so it'll be online?
It will be digital only. It will have no print product, but I'm sure they'll be doing online video as well.
Does that mean that other independent outlets will kind of diminish?
No, I don't think so. First of all, there's a lot of room in the news space for a lot of different kinds of providers. And I don't think we're suffering from an excess of accountability journalism. I think we might be suffering from an excess of Me Too journalism, where everybody covers the same sort of story. But I don't see this as crowding out other players in the marketplace.
Who are the investigative journalists, aside from Greenwald, that have allied with Omidyar?
Well, Laura Poitras, who has been Greenwald's partner in the Edward Snowden investigations, who's a video journalist and documentary maker. Jeremy Scahill, who is a national security journalist for The Nation, is another person who's involved. And I believe that they're going to soon begin widening that circle as they look around and hire others.
So aside from Omidyar, it seems pretty horizontal. Is there an editor, or are these people going to be pretty much writing and running everything?
I think you could call those initial people kind of a brain trust, but there's no editor yet. There's no hierarchy yet. It's too soon for any of that. I think they're just starting to get going.
You write in your blog, Jay, that if independent, ferocious investigative journalism isn't brought to the attention of general audiences, it can never have the effect that actually creates a check on power. Do you think there's a risk that this project might become the surveillance beat? Does that kind of negate attracting a general audience from the start?
No, I'm not worried about that, because I think when the full scale of the organization is unfolded over time, you'll see that it has a lot else besides that.
Jay, what would you say are the biggest challenges for this venture?
There's going to be a temptation to make it look like every other news organization, because that's what people know and that's what the people who you hire know. So from my point of view, the biggest challenge is just avoiding that, avoiding mimicking a CNN or a Washington Post or a Bloomberg, and actually trying to organize it from the ground up as something different, something digital, something that has learned the lessons of online journalism. And that's going to be a challenge.
I gather this project is creating kind of a buzz among your students at NYU. Are they seeing this as kind of the world they'll be working in?
It's funny you mentioned that, because one of them sent me a chat message while I was on the phone with Omidyar.
Really?
Yeah.
Asking what?
asking how she could be involved.
I thought so.
So yes, not just my students, but lots of people are already abuzz with it because, let's face it, it's important when somebody wants to put that kind of money and that kind of experience in building a company behind news, and in not just news, but the most serious, important forms of journalism. That is something that should create buzz, in my opinion.
Jay Rosen teaches journalism at New York University and blogs at pressthink.org. Jay, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Let's circle back to our top story, which today remains the fiscal mess in Washington. Yes, the debt limit is raised and the shutdown is over, but the dysfunction of the past 2 weeks is now part of how the world sees America. As we heard earlier, President Obama thinks it's even emboldened our economic competitors, like China. Well, one place to see how that's playing out is Kenya. Kenya is a key player in international trade, both as a gateway to Africa and as a conduit for African export goods. And China is a big player in Africa's economy. Ali Khan Sachu is a business analyst in Nairobi. Tell us first, Ali Khan, what did this debt debacle and shutdown do to the U.S. financial standing across the world?
Well, I think everyone has been just incredulous and watched this aghast as we've watched this dance at the very precipice, and then, you know, at the very last moment, a deal was struck. But I think, you know, absolutely everyone across the world is just horrified, I'm afraid. And I think there's very little that can change that perception. And the concern is that the rest of the world sees this state of dysfunction as the new American normal. And if that's the case, it seriously impairs the U.S. credit over the short, medium, and long term.
I mean, this went on for 16 days. Are you saying that by, say, day 14, that things were so bad that it pushed Kenyan businesses to look for investments elsewhere?
No one is sort of saying, you know, let's ditch the U.S., but I can guarantee you that this level of dysfunction would never be seen out of China. You know, China has in many ways floated Africa's boat. You know, there is a lot of cash that the Chinese are making available. You know, most African presidents dream their big dream and head to Beijing to try and get it fulfilled. This is not a likely thing when it comes to Washington because there isn't the money there and there is this level of dysfunction. So I think China becomes more attractive to African governments. However, I do think to African individuals, you know, we all still look to the U.S. For our culture and for a lot of other things.
It's interesting. Kenyans themselves have some very high-paid lawmakers, and Uhuru Kenyatta, the president, is the highest-paid head of state in the world relative to his country people. Mm. Do you think Kenyans have a unique window on the dysfunction of national leaders that kind of helps them understand organically what's been going on here, what had been going on here for the last 2+ weeks?
What a fascinating question. I imagine it does. I think, you know, we give our politicians a lot of leeway here. They're the most well-paid in the world when you look at it on a comparable basis. And the interest in Kenyan politics is just off the charts. The one local newspaper, Nation, makes more money than every newspaper in the USA put together.
Wow.
So there's a huge appetite for news. And I think in that context, you're quite correct. And that was a very interesting connection to make.
So tell us, what kind of advice do you want to give to U.S. lawmakers about debt default and shutdown? Because we all know they're going to be facing this again in a few months.
Well, it's going to be Groundhog Day, isn't it? And that's the other risk. And that's why I think it is a problem, because you can see, you can look down the road and see they just kicked the can down the road. They haven't got it fixed. So my advice would be, you know, this is playing with the faith and credit of the United States of America. It's not about a single party. It's about the USA. And, you know, if you look at it from that way, it's just not patriotic what's going on. It's not in the national interest what's going on. And they should put up and shut up. And if they want to fight a political war, go and fight it somewhere else. But if you're borrowing trillions of dollars from the rest of the world, and then you're telling people to butt out when they're forced to watch 14 days of complete farce, I think it really is a little bit rich.
Ali Khan Sachu, a business analyst in Nairobi, Kenya. Thanks so much for your thoughts.
Thank you, Marco.
Hi there, I'm Manasseh Piri, and I'm here to give you a little piece of Africa in music on The World.
as he always does. What better than a little music for a change of pace? Bring it, Manasseh.
Today we're going to the East African country of Uganda, the Pearl of Africa, where we're meeting a self-taught saxophonist who his name is Isaiah Katumwa. Sunrise. They say about Isaiah Katumwa in Uganda that he is the Kenny G of Africa. In fact, they say that he is the best saxophonist in that part of the world. Born and bred in Uganda, he actually hosts a weekly television program called Jazz with Isaiah on national TV every Friday night in Uganda. Here's a track called Nsima. A newspaper in East Africa described this music as indigenization of this beautiful wind instrument. And they said it's like speaking English with an East African accent. I call it Africanization of that particular wind instrument. The album that we're featuring today from Uganda, from Isaiah Katumwa, is called African Smoothie. And he says of this album and the music in it that it's African, it's smooth, and it's divine. Here's my last track for you, Africa. Africa is the time to rise and shine. Isaiah Katumwa from Uganda, from the album African Smoothie. It's African, it's smooth, and it's divine, and it's time for me to rise and go. I'm Manasseh Perry in Lusaka, Zambia. I'll see you next time.
Video of Isaiah Katumwa performing is also in the pocket and pretty darn smooth. We've got it at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.